This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week, cycling fans turn once again to the world's biggest cycling competition, the Tour de France. It's a grueling 21-stage race that takes about 3 weeks to ride. But another cycling event was also taking place this week, and it's a much quieter affair. Over 7 days, a group of Navajo cyclists, many of them kids, are riding 300 miles across the vast Navajo Nation, the reservation that stretches across New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona. It's a rugged, hot landscape and maybe not the most obvious place to stage a multi-day bike ride. But for these young bikers, the landscape has become an endurance test that keeps them close to their Navajo heritage. We sent staff writer Philip Gurevich out to the reservation a few months ago to find out more about the cycling there.
As a kid, you want to do something. I was looking out my little bus window, imagining myself riding a bicycle, right? But I'm bouncing around in there with all that dust and everything. Sometimes I even, with that dust on the window, I would draw a little bike and then just two wheels and the handlebar and just watch it. And as the road is going by, I just see this bike just flying through the area.
So where I'm from, where my clan is from, is up this canyon way at the very end where it starts.
Vincent Salabe tells me this story as we sit on the lip of Canyon de Chelly, which is this spectacularly beautiful spot. It's kind of a mini Grand Canyon. Vincent rode his bike out here this evening. He comes from around here. His family does. His ancestors have, for as long as anybody can remember. He's 38 now, but he took up biking as a kid.
We were in a tough situation with my family about that time. My dad had left. My mom was in between jobs. And during that time, a new man was in the house. Very alcoholic, abusive, and I just didn't want to be there. You know, I just wanted to get out, you know. I was 13 years old, and I went on a bike ride from here. A teacher sponsored it with the school. 17 of us got on the road and made a ride all the way down to Texas on mountain bikes from Walmart.
How many miles?
When I checked it, it was around 3,000 miles or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, and we were kids, man. So I was the youngest of the group.
That was 25 years ago, and Vincent still seems a bit blown away by what he accomplished and just how far he pedaled, that he kept going. He says he just really didn't want to stop. The bike felt like where he belonged. It clicked with something about him and about where he was coming from.
My representation of that is, you know, that's my horse. You know, that's my horse that takes me places. So that's always ingrained in me, is like that's how my mindset. Just trying to explore the lands that I always grew up on.
So a couple of years ago, when Vincent heard that another long ride was being organized on the res, he jumped at the chance to join. This one was a little more tame. Really, anything would be more tame. just 300 miles over 7 days. It was called the Tour de Sihassan.
So the center right here kind of comes down. Uh-huh. There's a cattle trail that goes all the way up the mountain. Our bike route is out there.
Sihassan means hope in Navajo. The tour was Claudia Jackson's idea.
In our five communities, we had 7 suicides within 3 months.
Claudia imagined this multi-day trip, where young people would not just get to ride a lot, but also to camp out every night, so they would really get to know each other.
You know, that sort of brings us together. We talk about things. We might not talk about that issue, but we get people to talk.
She decided to make the Tour of Sihassan a suicide awareness event. And that first year, she realized she was definitely onto something.
I had 2 individuals on the ride. One was a young boy. He was telling us a story that he had tried, and now he realizes that there's a reason for his life. And then being on the bike ride really made him think, because you're out there in the heat and you're really struggling physically and mentally. People really think out there. And one ride we did, this lady came up to me and she started crying and telling me about walking into her home and her son was, you know, had committed, and she didn't know where to go. And that's when we realized on the entire Navajo Nation, we only had 1 clinician, 1 psychiatrist, just, you know, psychology. Yeah. That's when a lot of things started happening to bring in more, more discussion, because with our tribe and our people, they don't talk about those things. They consider it taboo. If you talk about it, that's taboo. But for us, we knew we had to.
Claudia had started thinking that there should be more than a once a year event. She started thinking about organizing a cycling team. And she started talking with a former professional cyclist turned coach, not a Navajo, but he lived at the edge of the reservation in Gallup, New Mexico, named Scott Needham.
Yeah, that was great. That was so special.
I'd met Scott in Rwanda a while back. He was there helping to coach a group of young Rwandans who were becoming professional cyclists. That team, Team Rwanda, became a real success story. 2 riders had gone to the Olympics. So Scott knew firsthand how cycling develops resilience and can even restore a sense of self to people who've experienced deep trauma. As it happened, a couple of the Rwandan riders, Nathan Bukusenge and Rafiki Uimana, were visiting the States, and Scott asked them to join him on a road trip to check out the cycling scene on the reservation. When Vincent met Nathan and Rafiki, he didn't say much. He just took them for a ride. Nathan and Rafiki are tough riders. Nathan rode in the Rio Olympics.
Yeah, it's tough because first time we
started. I don't think they were quite prepared for the terrain.
Different terrain.
We'll be coming down right here. Look, I'll show you.
Vincent just hopped on his bike and they hopped on theirs, and he led them riding up and over and down between boulders at the edge of the canyon, then shooting off along the rim where they appeared in silhouette. When the sunset started to get gaudy behind them, they stopped to take it all in. And Vincent started talking about the history of his people.
The United States government gathered us up, babies and all, whatever we could carry, did away with our livestock right then and there, bam, 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 and said, we're going to go in that direction. And no chains involved, but at gunpoint. The people didn't know where they were going, ended up, they call it Huete. I just know it by Navajo name, Huete. Fort Sumner, that's where it is. We're taking all the way to Fort Sumner. They called that the Long Walk. And very similar to what the Cherokee went through with the Trail of Tears.
And everyone brought up the boarding schools, where so many Navajo kids had been shipped when they were young to be anglicized, Christianized, deracinated. Vincent was sent away.
I guess you say it grows on you. Yeah, I'm a really short-tempered person. And I just find that I'm mean, I'm angry, and this comes with all of the care that you're given there. You lose track of your surroundings, right? And pretty soon you're just like, hey, it's just me here. And everybody comes individualized. The purpose of our prayer is to remind us of all that is around us. Hayos Kosh is the early morning light. When you go out there, you see it, it's white, right? And then from there, everything grows.
Ah,
When we're out here and we gather as a family and we have these ceremonies and we sing, you become one right there. And from there, we try to encourage one another to stay strong and go against all of the things that are going on around us and that are trying to keep us from growing. And it's really hard to live out here, you know, it's tough.
When Vincent rode the Tour de Sahasin in 2016, he saw himself and all the kids pushing themselves to hang in there. The youngest rider in particular struck a chord in him, a 12-year-old named Nigel James who was just pedaling his heart out and made it through the whole 300 miles.
I saw how good he was, and I said, why not just get this kid a chance?
Well, he's like the age you were when you rode to Texas.
Perfect. Yes. I see myself a lot in him because at that age, I wish I had somebody to lead the way.
Where Vincent led Nigel was to the kind of riding we'd seen him doing at the edge of Canyon de Chelly, the kind that he felt was truest to who he was and where he was, like he was on horseback. This new form of riding belongs to an entirely different sport than conventional cycling. Enduro, it's called, and it involves going alone, hard and fast, down very, very challenging terrain. It's not a question of pedaling hard. It's more like downhill ski racing on an obstacle course of hard rock and gravel, with lots of jumping off cliffs and over crevices. In just 10 years or so, enduro has become a whole world. There are international competition circuits, professional riders, endorsement deals. You can watch some of these hotshots on YouTube videos if you've got a stomach for watching people who appear to be plunging to their deaths. Nigel took to enduro with a passion. So we set out the next morning to see Nigel.
KTNN, your native broadcast enterprise radio station.
We drove and we drove and drove and drove. The Navajo Nation is big. We put 1,100 miles on our truck in 3 days, and we listened to a lot of radio. We are really out there. Yeah, we're on this like rutted dirt road. We're looking to get to Nigel's house, but it's been a long, long time since we passed, even on the paved road, another car or a house. And here it looks like we're coming up into a sizable corral. We came to a horse corral, and beyond it to a house with a lot of heavy equipment around it and a traditional Navajo structure being built, a heavy log roundhouse called a hogan. There was a teenage boy there with a ponytail rocketing around on an orange enduro bike. That was Nigel. The Rwandans immediately recognized him as one of their own.
Yes, is it like a BMX track?
Oh, yeah.
BMX.
Yep. Right here is a technical one back there. We have a little playground.
All cyclists together, it's connection. Yeah, cycling, it's a good connection.
It was hard to believe that Nigel had only started riding a bike 2 years ago.
Then I met Vincent, and then he started taking me all over the place. Did my first race September, I think, the Flagstaff Enduro. Got my first podium over there. The second race in Tucson, and third.
Nigel was underselling himself. He'd been winning a lot of the races. Though he sounded like what he was, a boy very much at home in his parents' house, hanging out, just riding his bike around the yard. People kept telling us he was also a really disciplined and fanatical rider. He never seemed to get off his bike. He had the habit of sort of pulling up, talking for a few minutes, and then he'd just stand up on the pedals and shoot off. He'd built ramps and jumps all around the house, so he really felt that he was at home in a deep sense, like this was his place. He'd made it his place. But he wasn't just a kid who was serious about biking. It turned out he was also a kid who was really serious about the impact of his biking on his land.
Yeah, we're able to build a lot of things because there's so much land here, but we also don't want to do too much because we could be causing erosion, which is why I try to ride mainly on the rock or the hard packed.
As we were talking, Nigel's dad stepped in.
My mother-in-law, she went to go get the sheep for you. You guys are going to kill it. She said to sharpen your knife.
By you guys, he meant the Rwandans. Apparently, the family, when they realized they were having visitors from Africa, had wanted to make them feel welcome and at home, and had come up with this idea of inviting them to slaughter an animal as their honored guests. The only question was which was going to die today, a goat or a sheep.
I don't know how to kill a sheep. I don't. Yes.
There were ones who were like, we don't slaughter goats. Like, well, these people are really far out.
You want to go get it. Yeah, go for a ride, man, and then they're going to bring the sheep up here. Okay.
So Nigel took off, with Nathan and Rafiki trying to keep up with him.
We'll take the little one.
When the knives came out for the goat, it was a goat in the end, a kid goat. The Rwandans were nowhere to be seen.
No!
Nigel's family made quick work of the slaughter. After binding the animal's hoofs and brushing its neck with a sprig of juniper, his grandmother slit its throat. Nigel stripped off the skin, and the severed head was on the grill in about 15 minutes.
It takes a lot of time.
Meanwhile, inside the house, Nigel's mother and her sisters, and their mother and her sisters, and some of the younger children were gathered in the kitchen preparing the feast. The really strong feeling that you got right away, and it just deepened through the long hours of the afternoon and evening we spent there, was that this was a guy who was the opposite of all the alienation we've been hearing about amongst the youth. He was loved. He was cherished. He was supported. He was encouraged. He was being homeschooled, in large part to make sure that he grew up speaking Navajo, respecting the ways of the elders, and to protect him and shelter him and spare him so much of the grief that we were hearing about as a sort of given of much of reservation life. At sunset on the Black Mesa, Nigel's grandparents, his grandfather on horseback, his grandmother walking nearby, started herding the sheep up past the house.
Our ancestors, they roamed this place, so we don't want to go any other place but here. And our kids, grandkids, some live out in towns and cities, but for us old folks, we don't want to be out there. I don't. I like to roam without any fence as far as I can, this way, that way, out here. But I'm not getting any younger, so I would like to have like running water because of my age. So that's some of the things that we face up here.
For all of Nigel's family's attachment to their land and their traditions, it was striking how much they also completely supported him taking off into the world of enduro competitions, which is really a different world, a white Anglo world. But then, at one of these competitions in Utah, a funny thing happened.
Because, you know, there's not a whole lot of people of color at these places.
That's Nigel's mom. They met these guys called the Yazis.
So we automatically spotted them. We said, our yates, yate, which is hello in Navajo, yate.
Yeah, the Yazis, Jarrett and Terrence. Mm-hmm. Those guys are willing to take me in, train me, improve my technical ability. Yeah, but their place is crazy. They just have like big boulders everywhere. And then they have like woodwork connecting them, technical features, crazy stuff I don't even want to try.
Obviously, I wanted to meet these crazy Yazis, but when I asked if we could go out there the next day, it was the only time I felt from Nigel's family, who'd been so welcoming, that maybe we were trespassing a little. I let it go when we settled down to our feast of goat stew and pozole and the sky got dark and the stars came out. It was only much later, as we were getting ready to leave, that Nigel's dad took me aside and told me he'd got the word from the Yazis. It wasn't exactly an invitation. It was more like, if you want to tag along with Nigel, we won't run you off our land. The Yazis, of course, lived hundreds of miles away. So we drove, and we drove, and the road led us south and east into a kind of vast gravel pan of a plain that stretched out in all directions. It really felt like the inside of a kiln. It was hot. Just before noon, when the road up ahead appeared to be evaporating in the heat waves, we came around a bend. There was a pickup truck waiting that flashed its lights and headed out ahead of us. We followed and wound up in a yard surrounded by big red rocks. There was a tremendous amount of stuff surrounding a rather modest house, weightlifting gear and broken engines and all manner of scrap metal all over the place. And there were the Yazis. They were big guys, cousins, the younger one, Terrence, quite mild-mannered. And then came Jared. There was nothing mild about him. He pretty much charged at us. Marvin, Nigel's dad, had a sort of amused look, like, I told you they were crazy. And he made introductions.
We got a few guests here.
What's up, man?
I'm nothing.
Jared.
Nathan and Rafiki.
Yeah. Rafiki.
Yes.
That is an actual name. Yeah. Not a baboon.
Did he just call Rafiki a baboon? He seemed awfully happy to see him. And it took a second for everyone to register that Jared was making a Lion King reference.
All cross country?
Yeah.
Nice, dude. You guys kick ass. I saw some of that shit.
Jared grew up here, right here. This was his father's house. And like Vincent and Nigel, it turned out, he'd first got into riding a bike when he signed up for a multi-day ride in high school, an anti-drug ride. He liked riding on the road, but the nearest pavement was miles away. And what really clicked was mountain biking. It was the very early days of the sport.
All I knew is there was tires and dirt, and it was fun. Yeah. It's kind of like dirt biking, but without the motor.
He was good at it, too. But in his early 20s, he got distracted.
Got in trouble with the law. Got away from cycling, everything altogether for a while. I had to go do some time.
Jared said he had 8 DUIs by the time he went to prison. When he got out, he had a girlfriend who asked him, if you're not drinking, what are you going to do? He said he used to love biking, so she bought him a bike, and he started riding again, working out his anger on his pedals. He started going to races, and he started seeing people riding mountain bikes in a way that was more and more like he liked it, more like the rodeo, aggressive.
Adrenaline junkie, rode horses fast, did everything hard and fast out here. You know, road bulls, fucking road dirt bikes, quads, you know, wrecked 7 trucks. So, brought that all back here. And
Jared wanted to ride with other people, but it seemed to him that the few serious cyclists around didn't want anything to do with some Navajo guy.
Those white fuckers didn't want nothing to do with me. Fucking tried to talk to them, you know, and who the fuck are you? So I said, you know what? Fuck you. I'll fucking start my own shit.
So he built his training facility in his backyard, taking full advantage of the landscape to build this death-defying obstacle course. This was enduro before there was enduro. When he and his brother and cousins started showing up at races, self-trained and ready for anything, they got an instant reputation.
Every fucking bike shop knows us. Every fucking good rider in Flagstaff knows us. A lot of these people in the industry know us. Fucking the Yazzie brothers, Resnick riders. Fucking infamous, kind of.
Is that your own title, the Resnecks?
Yes.
That's excellent.
Since Jared had always done it his way, made it up as he went along, not unlike Vincent and Nigel, I wondered if an organized team made any real sense out here. Was that the way to get kids into it?
I want to see more kids, but they're too lazy. They're trying to act white. That's the way I look at it. Our communities are put in together. They want to fucking look good. They don't want to go out and herd sheep. They don't want to be out in the sun. You know, to be really home is to be out here. Remember your language. I tell these guys, my siblings and my sisters tell me that. Mm-hmm. Remember your fucking language, man. Speak it. Don't be shy of it. I do. I do that. I go to town and I speak it. We're not going to be Navajos here in the near future. It's just going to be a color of skin. That's it. You know? And then they're going to take this fucking, what we have left, the reservation, say, oh, you guys are not a nation anymore. You two, you're not together. You're broken. They're going to take it back. And then it's all gone.
As Jared held court, swearing like a Resnick, Nigel and his parents stood there, grinning. And I realized this wasn't the world they wanted to shelter Nigel from. Jared was complimenting them on their choices and how they'd raised their son.
There's no water and there's nothing. You go to herd sheep, you're walking in sand.
Still, they hadn't come for the small talk. They'd all come to ride. And pretty soon, everyone set off to check out the Yazzie's famous setup. First stop was a series of massive red rock outcroppings, boulders that sort of mushroomed out of the ground. It looked like a piece of the planet that had just been created. And one of the first rock faces we came to was marked with a series of ancient white petroglyphs.
We'll meet you up there, Nigel.
Oh yeah. Those scratchings there, are those cattle brands or
no? Those are ancient.
They are.
Thousands of years old.
Like a lizard kind of thing. The one on the right.
Yeah, why not? It's pretty. Go for it, Nigel. Do a no-hander.
Watching them ride these rocks really brought home what Jared Yazzie had been saying, connecting bicycling to the landscape here and to his heritage. It wasn't some Anglo import, the way I had assumed. They had made enduro riding their own, like speaking their own language.
Let it roll. Feather your brakes. Just roll in.
It isn't my language, and it wasn't the Rwandans' or Scots' language either. They followed Nigel on their bikes, but they always stopped well short of the rock edges when he took off over them. None of them could do what Nigel was doing.
Oh, yeah! Yeah, I'm good. I went too high to the right.
Even Jared Yazzie wiped out at one point as he tried to keep up with the kid. He gashed open his arm. As Jared stood there, bleeding and grinning and urging Nigel on, I had just one last question for him. He and his Resnick riders and Vincent and the riders I'd met in Rwanda, like Nathan and Rafiki, were all scarred, each in their own way, by deep childhood traumas. They'd turned to the bike as a way to ride away from their pasts. But Nigel seemed like a happy kid from a nurturing family, a boy surrounded by love, really. And I wondered, did Jared think Nigel could really be the best if he wasn't driven by some kind of pain or demons like the rest of them? What Jared said was, I've got enough for three generations.
I got enough for three generations, man. Let that die with me.
There you go.
Come on, Nigel! Nice job, dude. It's a kid, dude. Fucking. Damn. Hell yeah, 14, yeah.
That was Jared Yazzie of the Yazzie Brothers, speaking to us from the Navajo Nation. We also heard from Nigel James and Vincent Salabe. They spoke with the New Yorker's Philip Gurevich, and you can find all of Philip's writing over the years at newyorker.com. And be sure to take a look at newyorker.com to see photography and videos of the enduro cyclists in the Navajo Nation. It's really something to see. And that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Until next week, follow us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Ye, with help from Jamie York, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.